Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Ukraine Calling. I'm Oksana Smerechuk for Hromadske Radio in Kyiv. We're bringing you our feature interview with our new interview host, Alex Wishart. It's now 5 years since the annexation of Crimea, and Alex will be talking to Maxim Svyazhentsev, a Ukrainian historian who grew up in Crimea, and through his research has a good understanding and insights into Crimea today. And this will be followed by some new music, also with a Crimean flavor. But first of all, some highlights from the week's news. This week in Ukraine has seen a number of surfacing corruption allegations. Allegations were made against the son of Oleg Hladkovsky, who is deputy head of Ukraine's Security and Defense Council and a close ally of President Petro Poroshenko. It was alleged that he took a leading role in a scheme that pocketed millions of dollars from state defense enterprises. And this is according to a story published on February 25th by Nashi Hroshi, an investigative journalism project. The investigation exposed a small group of individuals who were smuggling used parts for military equipment from Russia and selling them to Ukrainian defense companies at inflated prices. Ukraine's Constitutional Court has overturned a law against officials enriching themselves, a move that has raised concerns about a weakening of Ukraine's fight against corruption. This move would also affect Ukraine's ability to obtain loans from the International Monetary Fund. The National Anti-Corruption Bureau of Ukraine stated that the court decision meant criminal proceedings in all 65 cases detectives were investigating would have to be closed. This would include illegal enrichment investigations of judges and other public officials. The Constitutional Court had overturned the law on the grounds that it contravened the presumption of innocence principle. It would have obliged suspected officials to prove their assets were legitimate rather than obliging prosecutors to show assets were obtained through corrupt practices. Meanwhile, President Petro Poroshenko sought to remedy this by proposing to draft new legislation aimed at curtailing corrupt officials. The warship USS Donald Cook has arrived in Odessa for a scheduled port visit. It will stay in the port for 3 days as part of continued U.S. Black Sea presence and support for NATO regional partners by the U.S. Navy. U.S. Special Representative Kurt Volker has described the destroyer's visit as a strong symbol of the United States' commitment to the people of Ukraine. Ukraine's central bank is launching a pilot project for a national digital currency, the e-hryvnia. Alexandra Yablonevsky from the National Bank of Ukraine stated that the bank has now been conducting practical research in this area. It would help to move Ukrainian payments away from a system heavily weighted towards cash payments. And there will be no Ukrainian participant in the 2019 Eurovision contest to be held in May this year. After holding a Ukraine-wide competition based on popular vote to find a national contestant, the National Public Television and Radio Company declared the winner to be the singer Anna Korsun, who performs as Maruv. The singer refused to sign a contract which spelled out conditions how to be a cultural ambassador for Ukraine and which would limit her performances in Russia. After the runners-up also withdrew, the national broadcaster announced Ukraine's non-participation.
Hello, welcome. This is the Ukraine Calling podcast. My name is Alexandra Wishart, currently intern here at Hromadske Radio. I'm very happy to announce as my guest on this week's program, Maxim Svyazhentsev. Am I pronouncing that right, Maxim?
Svyazhentsev.
Svyazhentsev. I'm very happy that you will be on our show today. You are a scholar and analyst of Crimean history, currently completing your PhD at the University of Western Ontario in Canada. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
And you're also a prominent Euromaidan activist. So I was wondering, as you are very much familiar with Ukrainian situation and you have studied in Poland and Canada alike, I hope you will be able to shed a unique perspective on our topic of this week, which will be Crimea 5 years after the occupation. So welcome to the program, Maxim.
Thanks for having me.
So, Maxim, what are your thoughts 5 years after the annexation? Where are we at?
Well, Crimea is still occupied. We still have very grave issues with human rights violations in Crimea. We have military collision between Ukrainian and Russian Navy forces and other military forces in the Kerch Strait last November. And we have practically ignorance from the international community towards the issue, because it seems right now that the international community is accepting the annexation as a new status quo, which is very problematic.
Mm-hmm. Just a couple of days ago, Mike Pompeo made a very recent statement reconfirming the U.S. stance on Crimea, that it should be returned to Ukraine. What are your thoughts on that? Like, how does it fit into this ignorance?
Well, you know, we've heard many statements over the last 5 years. And as you might know, in Ukraine, the phrase "we strongly condemn" became kind of a meme, right? So it became a joke. Europe and United States have been strongly condemning Russians' actions in Crimea and in Donbas in eastern Ukraine and elsewhere for many years, but nothing really is done. And Mike Pompeo is representing the current White House administration that has not implemented any serious sanctions against Russia since Donald Trump came to power. So As a person coming from Crimea, I would like to see more actions rather than words, because we've heard enough words over the last 5 years.
Mm-hmm. It is very understandable. And in regards to your European Union, would you say that there is a different stance taken by the European Union?
Well, they continue making statements, which I think, again, is another iteration of a status quo, right? Like nothing really changes in rhetorically. However, as we see lately, there is a somewhat strong, or I don't know what the strength of the wave is, but there is a wave of changing attitudes towards Russia lately in Europe, and we see it with the problem of a Nord Stream. We know that Merkel, German Chancellor Angela Merkel, supported Nord Stream publicly not so long ago. We've heard statements by various European foreign ministers, for example, calling on both sides of the war in Donbas to de-escalate the situation, forgetting which side is aggressor and which side is on its defensive. So again, rhetorically, they support Ukraine and they support Crimea's belonging to Ukraine. They support Crimea's Ukrainian status of Crimea, but it doesn't seem like they're willing to do anything about it, and it does more and more look like a new status quo, a new fait accompli in the international relations, which really worries me a lot.
I understand. From your perspective, what would be the measurements that you would like to see the international arena basically exercising in terms of Crimean occupation?
Well, of course, we cannot talk about any kind of military intervention, because let's be realistic. But as we know, there are different types of sanctions implemented right now against Russia. And there is a group of sanctions that were implemented for Russia's annexation of Crimea. And another part of sanctions is implemented for Russia's intervention in Donbas. So those are two different types of sanctions. I would say that the serious sanctions are those which are implemented for Donbas. Those sanctions that are related to Crimea are not serious at all. Like, let's say we do have ban for international companies working in Crimea, and there are ways in which international companies still interact with Crimea. A famous Siemens case, for example, was gas turbines. So those sanctions should be more serious. They should become more and more serious, and the occupation should become more expensive for Russia. For example, Europe and United States could implement sanctions for the Kerch bridge or for the military collision in the Kerch Strait. So far, we've heard talks about implementing sanctions for capturing Ukrainian Navy servicemen, but it appears now that those sanctions will be personal again. So again, against those will be sanctions against separate people, not the country as a whole, not grave economic sanctions that we could expect.
Okay, I would like you as an expert to get some more of your perspective on the situation in Crimea itself. So 5 years afterwards, what is the political, the economical, and the human rights situation?
I should start by saying that I haven't been to Crimea since 2013, so I cannot have personal perspective on the situation. I do have relatives living in Crimea, however, and I do have friends who visit Crimea from time to time, including doing research or visiting family. So I cannot say much about disillusionment because there is no real realistic way of measuring it, because Russia's propaganda in Crimea has always been very strong, and Russia's image of pro-Russian Crimea has always been very strong and carefully supported. But I do know that there is a certain level of disillusionment, and I know it from personal interactions with people who I'm not going to name. I do know that there is a certain level of disillusionment against Russian government and Russia, which doesn't necessarily mean that those people like Ukraine suddenly. It's just disillusionment against Russia. Let's not get too excited.
Could you specify which type of disillusionment that would be? Why are there disillusioned?
There are heavy economic problems, water supply problems, prices are very high. There is no access to, let's say, internet software. You cannot use Google or any Google services. There is no real access to banks or post. I don't know what else. Medical care. There is very, very heavy, strong, like hard situation with medical care in Sevastopol and all over Crimea, because doctors just retire with not having chances to earn money there, and medical care, it's just basically impossible to get medical care in Crimea.
And does this frustration, does it translate into sort of public unrest? Are there any initiatives, any signs of protest? How would you evaluate that?
What I know is there was a wave of protests against requisition of land, like there was a few years ago in Sevastopol, a lot of land was taken by the state from landowners. So there was a certain level of protesting in that sphere, but that was kind of a protest that you have in Russia, like appealing to Putin. Other than that, you cannot really protest in a concentration camp, you know, like there is very limited ways in which you can protest publicly. I mean, the protest is mostly kept in the kitchen, you know, just like in Soviet times.
In terms of militarization of the peninsula and Crimea, what is your opinion? Is there any stationing of rockets, or are the Russians moving in for good? What's your stance on that?
Well, here I can only say what I know, again, from secondary sources and from the information published in the Ukrainian media. I do know from personal experience, not my personal experience, but from personal sources, that there is a very high level of militarization of the peninsula. From some media sources, I know that there are whole military camps built in northern Crimea to host more servicemen. There are regular searches by FSB, Russian security services, in Crimean Tatar homes. So that's not as much of a militarization topic, but human rights topic. Like, I've heard stories, again, stories from people I know, who were on their way to a Crimean Tatar village, and then received calls saying the village is surrounded by FSB, don't come.
Mm-hmm. And do you believe that the Crimean Tatar community is specifically targeted in those cases?
Oh, yes. The very presence of Crimean Tatars as an indigenous people in Crimea undermines the whole Russian claim for the peninsula. So, yes, they will be forced out. Just as Russian tradition always done, they always looked at nations according to their loyalty to the state. Crimean Tatars has always been looked at as not loyal to the state. So Crimean Tatar problem will become more and more serious for Russia, because they are the force that undermines Russian claim for the peninsula.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of the risk of Russians actually properly moving in, being sent from the mainland, do you have any ideas whether that's a realistic thing to take place?
Well, they say that Sevastopol has now traffic jams during the rush hour, which has never happened before, which means that the population of Sevastopol rose dramatically. There was several statements by Crimean Tatar Majlis saying that there is a very high, several hundred thousands of Russians being transferred to the peninsula. There was a big wave in 2014, for instance, when people like policemen, judges, prosecutors, so like servicemen, were moved from mainland Russia, from Russia to Crimea to work. And again, I know it both from media and from personal sources that there was a whole wave in 2014 and 2015 of people moving to Crimea for permanent residence.
Mm-hmm. And what is your assessment of Putin trying to secure water by force or to open a land corridor to the Crimean Peninsula?
I'm not a military expert, so I cannot talk about military operations on the land. I'm just not capable of doing that. But the problem with the Kerch Strait, because that's what I'm assuming you're asking about, has been going on since early summer, and the organization called Maidan for Foreign Affairs has been reporting on it for months before the collision happened. So it looks like it is a way for Russia to claim the Sea of Azov. It also looks like a way for Russia to claim Crimea on yet another level, and to blockade Ukrainian ports of Berdansk and Mariupol economically. So that's a combination of military and economic warfare. I cannot say much. I cannot make any provisions, but the situation is happening as we speak. Still, it's not resolved. I just read today, I think, that the number of vessels going through Kerch Strait under Ukrainian flag is very low.
I see. And I've read in the past that this could also be an issue of securing fresh water from the Dnipro River, and that that is one of the motivations behind securing this area. Have you heard anything in regards to that?
I've heard this version too, because yes, access to fresh water in Crimea is a big problem, especially for agriculture in northern Crimea. Basically, the peninsula became, the northern part of peninsula becomes desert without water, and the land becomes very salty. So there is a version of that's a way to fight for land bridge to get water. But we, like, as a person who is not a military expert, I cannot really evaluate the strengths of this version.
I see. And maybe going back to human rights, I found the issue of the Crimean Tatar community very interesting, especially seeing that there has been an exhibition just recently opened here in Kiev, which was called 5 years after occupation. Do you believe that this specific issue will be one playing a role in the future? Like, how can Ukrainians also support Crimean Tatars that are remaining on the peninsula?
Well, we certainly, as a state, Ukraine as a state certainly should support Crimean Tatar culture, because Crimean Tatars are one of the indigenous people on Ukrainian territory, so we need to support Crimean Tatar language schools, the study of Crimea. We need to write Crimea into Ukrainian narrative, need to write into historical narrative, cultural narrative. We really need to support Crimean Tatar culture. We need to be able to claim Crimea by supporting Crimean Tatars.
Could you give an example of how to actively write them into the Ukrainian narrative, like any perspective?
Well, cultural events is one of the is one of the dimensions of that, but also we need to write history of Crimea, because so far the history that is being written or has been written is that of Russia. It's not really a history of Crimea, it's a history of Russia in Crimea. So we need to create a narrative, a historical narrative of Crimea that would give voice to Crimean Tatars and to other indigenous nations of the peninsula. We need to decolonize Crimea, because I believe that Crimea was a settler colony of Russia, of Russian Empire and then Soviet Union. So basically, in order to create this narrative, we need to give voice to the indigenous people.
I see. So thank you very much. I noticed that the time is gone. I was wondering if you have any final thoughts or any specific message that you would like to share with our audience.
My message would be, do not forget about Crimea. The situation is very serious, and it's not just a problem between Russia and Ukraine. That's a problem that undermines the stability of the whole international system.
Our guest this week was Maxim Shvizhentsev, scholar and analyst on Crimean history at the University of Western Ontario.
And for our music, now we remember that 5 years ago, Russia annexed Crimea. People were forced to leave their homes, including Crimean Tatars. But the Crimean Tatar punk rock band Shatur Gudur continues to make music. They just released a new album called Sinirlar Hayir, which means safe borders, safe travel across borders. And you'll see the cover image on their new album is a black and white photo from the spot where there is now a border between Ukraine and Crimea. One of the songs on the new album is called Lugat. It's in both Crimean Tatar and Ukrainian. Enjoy.
Just move.
Next week, Bohdan Mihailo will be hosting the show, and we'll be back with more conversation about people and events in Ukraine. So tune in again for a new edition of Ukraine Calling. We'd be happy to receive any feedback from you, and you can write to us at ukrainecalling@hromadskeradio.org. This is Oksana Smerechuk in Kyiv. Thanks so much for listening.